It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. In the world of higher education, students in schools with the least financial need often receive the most government funding, and vice versa. That's one finding from a new report from UW-Madison's Student Success Through Applied Research Lab. The lead author of the report joins us now for a look at the causes of funding disparities and to make the case that equity-based funding models could help more students succeed in higher education. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think colleges and universities in Wisconsin are getting enough funding from the state and federal government? Do you have experience at maybe a smaller school or one with less funding? Could you see a lack of resources around you as a student or staff or faculty member? How should the government decide how much funding they grant towards each college and university? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nick Hillman is a professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. He's the director of the Student Success Through Applied Research Lab. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thank you, Rob, for the invitation. Happy to be here.
This follows up on an older report you were part of that stated basically the rich get richer when it comes to higher education and college institutions. Can you lay out some of the funding issues you see that makes the schools that need the funding the least maybe get the most of it?
It's a really complex problem where we have this real paradox. You have, for example, a very small percentage of universities around the country, just 1% of all the colleges, hold 54% of all of the endowments. That's all the sort of philanthropic money that they generate from donors. So you have a very small percentage of colleges holding the vast majority of wealth, and it's actually no different than our households. So 1% of households have about the same amount of, you know, the financial capital in the U.S. So the same kind of inequality we see all over the place in America doesn't stop at higher education. We see the same kind of inequalities where a very few number of colleges have the majority of resources, but that's not where the students enroll. So it's really imbalanced.
Let's go to the other end of the spectrum from that small group with that huge amount of money. Talk about the schools that might serve, in particular, low-income students that might have a guarantee of access to students from their community or their state. Paint us a picture of what money looks like there.
Well, money is there. I mean, this is not a story of, having $0. These institutions, we call them broad access institutions. Oftentimes, you think of your community college, your technical college, a public university nearby. These institutions both enroll the majority of students who apply. So they're not super selective, and they have a wide array of academic missions. So they're oftentimes training teachers, nurses, public safety personnel, you name it, people who stay in the region where the college is located. And at the same time, these institutions receive far less money per student from state governments than, say, research universities or major, more selective institutions that we oftentimes hear about in the news. And so sometimes that makes sense. Maybe it's just because they have a different business model. It's just more expensive to deliver education in certain institutions. But oftentimes that's not the case. And what we have is the colleges that enroll the vast majority of students have the least amount of resources. And as a result, oftentimes can't get the kind of outcomes that the more selective colleges have.
Let's key in there on those outcomes for individual students. For that student, maybe from a low-income background, say, who does go to that access college or community college or what have you, what does it mean that they have that disproportionately low amount of resources going to their institution?
It's really tricky. And it's, you know, as I say this, I want to be also very sensitive to my own biases and any sort of like framing that might come across negative or sort of deficit based, we say. So students come to college from all walks of life. They're not always the 18-year-old right out of high school. You know, it's oftentimes folks who are working full time. They're carrying a lot of different responsibilities, maybe even caring for family members. And they're going to college with a lot of extra needs around them that just make life tough and in a lot of different ways. And so when they get to college and now they maybe enroll part time or maybe they are enrolled full time, but they sometimes just need extra resources to just be able to make their education work well for them. And what I mean by extra resources, it could be financial aid. That's oftentimes what we think about. Give somebody a scholarship and that'll help. And it's true. Having an experience where a student goes to a college where their college can be responsive to their needs. The college has enough staff members to be able to provide academic advising. The college has enough faculty members and courses to be able to offer the kind of classes that they need. A lot of times the colleges are strapped with their capacity. They don't have all of those things that might make it a little bit easier for the student to be successful. And so it's a little bit of, the financial aid story, but it's a big part of the actual what we call capacity of the college to just serve some basic quality of care.
One example of capacity you give in the study, I believe, is, say, advisors. One school might have a limited number of advisors per student. They can check into that student once a semester or once a year. Another school might have a bigger academic team. They can check in regularly. Maybe they have an online system that can help monitor the student's progress toward graduation. That's the kind of thing we're talking about that can make a big difference toward student success down the road?
It is. And what's great about this is it's not just, me and our research team, Dr. Amberly Dzinski and Eunji Yu, she's a doc student at UW-Madison. It's not just us sort of, spitballing ideas, but we're drawing from all the research evidence that's really been mounting over the last several years, really well-designed studies that are finding that the things that really can make a difference for students, a positive difference in students' lives, especially students at these broad access institutions, are sometimes expensive. And sometimes the colleges don't have the money to cover those expenses. And so what we're seeing in the research is that money matters greatly. And the way that programs are designed for students to be, successful also matters greatly. And not every college has the same kind of capacity to serve students well.
Talking to Nick Hillman from UW-Madison Student Success Through Applied Research Lab, talking about a new report on how we fund colleges and universities in the whole country, not just Wisconsin, and why some schools have a lot of resources, others don't, and the students at the ones that don't, in some cases, might benefit from more of them. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Maybe you have an experience to share as a parent or student or staff or faculty member. Join in at 800-642-1234. Nick, the solution or the suggestion you offer in this report is an equity-based financial funding system for states, maybe even for the federal government. What do you mean by that?
Well, this term, equity-based funding, it's got a really interesting backstory, and I'll share that briefly. But before sharing it, I think one thing that we're really aware of and sensitive to was even just using the word equity in today's political climate can be very confrontational, controversial at least. And so I think what we did in this report is we tried to just not take the controversial flavor to this. And we framed equity around two basic principles that have been around for decades. The first one is to think about what we call horizontal equity, basically treating everybody equally across the board. And then we have what's called vertical equity, treating people in different situations differently across the board. And we see this in our tax policies. We see this all across different social welfare programs, different public policy issues that have nothing to do with social welfare, where basically, if somebody has the least amount of resources, you try not to bog them down with burdens or with taxing them more, basically. So that's kind of a issue of fairness that we oftentimes talk about in other areas of public policy, and we can and should talk about it in higher education finance as well. And so we bring a little bit of that into the conversation. And we also bring this issue of civil rights into the conversation that maybe does bring a little bit more controversy to it. But the point is that, and we see lawsuits around the country around these issues, that students sometimes say, hey, our college doesn't have adequate resources, and our college looks a whole lot like the college down the road, except for the thing that's different is our college serves a lot of people of color. And if you can find that there are systematic effects on protected groups, then you might have a civil rights case to be made. And so our report gets into that. We don't solve it all, but we say being attentive to those issues, those equity concerns that have a long history in American public policy can really benefit higher education in rethinking our funding models.
So if a lawmaker came to you and said, yeah, we want to lift up the hood and look at the funding engine for our universities here, and we're open to this notion that some schools are under-resourced and leaving some people short here, where would you recommend they start? This is a long, complicated system. It's evolved over decades. What kind of start would you suggest they make?
Absolutely. You know, we see it the same way. Like, this is just, you know, helpful guidance of things we've learned in the literature. Again, this is not just us kind of coming up with some ideas out of the blue, but all of these design principles, we call them, are stemmed from theory and research evidence behind it. And so some of the things that we would recommend if a state was interested in rethinking their funding model, we would basically put them into maybe three buckets. In one bucket, you might have some metrics. You might have some data where you say, okay, if a college serves a certain proportion of low-income students or a certain proportion of students of color, something like that, they might get a little extra money because of these inequalities that exist. And we see some states do exactly what I just described. In fact, even the federal government has some programs like this. And so we highlight those in the report. So in one part, we can kind of get at it through our funding formulas. And at the same time, equity and fairness and sort of rethinking change, positive directions of change, require a lot more than tinkering with formulas. Requires thinking really carefully about stakeholders and how do you build broad coalitions and how do you support the kind of innovation in higher education that we think can really improve experiences for students. And so we have a list of other potential ideas here around how to support organizational learning and improvement for helping students. And we also have ideas around how to make these programs, if you're going to have a new funding model, how do you just make them work well? What are we learning from the research world that says, here are some basic kind of, we call them administrative burdens or administrative characteristics that can help these policies work well. So basically trying to cull all of that information together in one report is what we aimed to do. And we think that it offers some guidance for policymakers or folks who are just interested in just like thinking about these issues in new ways.
We're talking to Nick Hillman, professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis and director of the Student Success Through Applied Research Lab at UW-Madison. He's the lead author of a new report on funding disparities in higher education. He makes the case that a lot of times the schools that need more funding often get less funding from state and federal governments. He has, as you're hearing, some prescriptions for change. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about the ideas our guest is presenting about how we fund higher education? Are there changes you'd like to see here in Wisconsin? Did you attend a school or work at one or send your kids to a school where you thought, gosh, if they put a little more money into blank, it would have helped a lot with the outcomes for the students there? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up the conversation with Nick Hillman, professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and director of the Student Success Through Applied Research Lab at UW-Madison. He's lead author of a new report on funding disparities in higher education and why, in some cases, schools that serve lower income students may get the least money, the fewest resources from the state and federal government. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. With your thoughts on this, your questions for our guest, do you want to see changes in the way Wisconsin puts money into the university, the UW system, the technical college system? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, questions, and experiences. Nick, in the report, you lay out, different states handle these things differently. What stands out to you in terms of Wisconsin and how we fund our higher education and how it fits into the story you're telling?
There's one really interesting policy in Wisconsin that we found in a few other states, but it's not as common as what I would have assumed. And it's an equalization formula for the technical colleges, where basically my understanding is that if a region or a community doesn't bring up enough revenue to a certain floor, that then the state will kind of kick in some money to bring that district up to the floor. California has a more popular model, a similar model, where basically this equalization formula is designed to make sure that their community colleges get a minimum amount of money that they know will help the institution with its operations and be able to deliver instruction. And so Wisconsin has a model like that. Whether and how it works, we were not in the process or in the business of evaluating it, but we just wanted to acknowledge that there is policy on the books in Wisconsin, but also in some other states that we wanted to just draw attention to and say, if you're a policymaker interested in these ideas, here are some places you might look to find some examples that might work in your situation.
One method of funding that you looked at that's in some states, I don't know if we have this here in Wisconsin, it's a performance-based, saying if you graduate X number of students in X amount of time or things like that, you'll get more money. Your report raises some concerns about that as to how it might affect, you know, the schools that allow for higher access for students.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, because actually, if I could just maybe tell a little bit of background story here. A lot of my earlier work, maybe 10 years ago or so, was on these state performance-based funding policies. And what we were finding in the research was that when states adopt these funding models with the idea that if you, you know, reward colleges for doing well, they'll get, you know, they'll have better outcomes. And we found that that wasn't happening by and large across the country, even in states that have a really high dosage, they've really gone all in with this funding model. We've kept finding consistent results where it wasn't really having the desired effect or the effect we would have assumed. And that's kind of unfortunate from a researcher point of view, because we're like, well, it doesn't seem like it worked. And so the next question is, well, what would work better? And it was really a good pivotal moment in my career to be able to reflect on, like, you know, it's easy to sort of point to problems. It's a lot harder to point to solutions. And so, you know, I think that the field has learned a lot from the performance funding experiments over the years, and I think is now sort of gaining consensus that we need to invest in the capacity of the colleges first. We need to make sure that they have some minimal amount of resources to then judge them on their performance. And if you're not at some minimal threshold, well, then maybe the high stakes performance isn't really the best diagnosis or the best solution for your situation. So anyhow, it's kind of an interesting full circle reflection for me, where this performance funding negative result has led me down this path of trying to think differently about finance. And I think a lot of states are trying to move into this direction too, of what do we do? How can we do it better?
Let's bring on a caller. Johanna is with us in Appleton. Johanna, hi.
Hi there. So I am a student within the UW system, specifically UW Oshkosh. But I am also a graduate of a 2-year school in the UW system as well. I went to Fox. And I'm a bit of a non-traditional student. I'm a little bit older now. When I first graduated high school, the 2-year school had a bunch of programs, a bunch of clubs, and you can definitely see the lack of funding within these 2-year schools over just a series of like 5 years. And piggybacking off that, you can see in UW Oshkosh, I know, just had a huge cut of funding that resulted in laying off a lot of staff and faculty, kind of like whether it be cleaning people or teaching. But most of the payments are to administrators as far as wage. I was wondering if this kind of could play a part in the inequality, I guess you could say, between schools that have a higher economic population versus lower economic population.
Johanna, thanks a lot for sharing your experience. Nick, your thoughts for Johanna?
Yeah, that's a great question. And absolutely, we see some patterns here in terms of the mix of, you know, finding what's the right mix of having the right number of professors and instructors versus staff members and administrators. And the answer is that there's not one magic number for any institution. All the context differs depending on place to place. But I think this broader trend and this broader question about whether or not, you know, administrators for universities are kind of inflating expenses and making it more difficult for colleges to have resources is a sort of perennial question. And I think what I do when I think about this issue is I try to understand, why do colleges have administrators and have folks other than faculty members involved? And the answer is oftentimes more obvious than what I would have assumed. We have to comply with federal and state laws. Colleges have to comply with various laws. They have to administer programs and make sure that they're accountable for administering them well. And because of that, we have a lot of administrative offices and practices that are there to support students, even if sometimes it's hard to understand why do we have a certain, role at the university. Oftentimes, I would say you can track it back to either some sort of compliance, federal or state compliance issue, or some sort of quality of care. Like this, just an administrator that helps support the experience for students. Now, it differs from college to college, but that's basically how I think about that issue.
Johanna, thanks a lot for that call. In our last minute or so, Nick, you have this report out. We've talked a little bit about lawmakers here. What are you hoping that decision makers, whether in state government, in university systems, federal government, whatever, what are you hoping that they glean and take from your report?
I'd say probably two things. The first one is that there are strategies out there that states and the federal government are already using to try to achieve improvement around issues of inequality. And so I hope that if, you know, somebody picks it up, that they can look for some solutions out there that might be useful for their context. So that's one. And on the other hand, it has nothing to do with solutions. It's more about just thinking differently about higher ed finance and just like imagining what could a better system look like? What might a more fair system look like? And having some of those conversations that we've had for decades in K through 12 education, start to have some of them in higher education with the hopes of making funding more fair so that students can have a better chance at being successful in college.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for the invitation.
That's Nick Hillman, professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis and director of the Student Success through Applied Research Lab at UW-Madison. He joined us today for a look at the causes and some possible solutions to funding disparities in our higher education system. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network.